Runoff, a crime novel about election fraud, evokes a curious timelessness of classic detective fiction. A noir gem, says Mystery Scene Magazine. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com. Chapter 32, Better Red Than Dead. It was Diego, of course. He designated one of Wood's construction sites in the Mission as the meeting place and told me I had 15 minutes to get there. Every minute I was late would mean one less finger or toe for Cassia. If they ran out of digits, they would find other things to cut. I was to come by myself and lose the Glock. Cops would mean Cassia's body would never be found, because she wasn't going to be on site. "Then how do I know that you'll let her go?" I asked. "You don't," said Diego, and hung up. It was a lose-lose situation, but Chris agreed that doing what they wanted was the lesser of two evils. At least we would be keeping the ball in play, and maybe Cassia would not be hurt. With all the crummy cards she'd been dealt in life, I couldn't bring myself to simply walk away. The corner of 14th and Mission was the address Diego gave. I remembered it as the location of an abandoned federal armory. Apparently Wood had obtained the property and was busy putting up another of his low-income developments. We made good time to the neighborhood, but I stopped about 3 blocks away to let Chris out. I passed him the Glock and told him to use his judgment. "What does that mean?" he said, pinching the barrel of the gun between his thumb and forefinger like he was gripping a dead mouse. He knew how to shoot because I'd taught him, but he'd never been comfortable with the idea. "It means what it means," I said. "I'm trusting you to do what you think is best. But if you do follow me to the site, please be careful and don't get yourself caught. You're the only one besides me that knows what the hell is going on." He started to say something about picking a fine time to trust him, but I shoot him out of the car and sped up Mission to the edge of the property. It was 1:26. By my watch, I'd made it with 3 minutes to spare. In a desperate, message-in-a-bottle sort of gesture, I used those minutes to take out my cell phone and to send my first text message. Then I powered the phone down and pulled the car up to the corner. The hangar-sized brick building I remembered was gone. The only thing left was a gaping hole. 10 species of construction equipment ringed the pit with buckets, shovels, and loaders dug into the earth like dinosaurs feeding. A chain-link fence enclosed the property, but the gate to it yawned wide open. A ramp of packed earth led from street level to the bottom of the graded excavation, where a sedan with tinted windows was parked with its headlights on. I couldn't think of anything else to do but drive down the ramp and park by the sedan, which turned out to be a 1970s vintage Mercedes. With the tinting on the Mercedes windows and the only light coming from the car's headlamps, I couldn't see in. I cut the motor on the VW and stepped outside. Mercifully, the rain had stopped, but my hands trembled as I closed the driver's door. I stood frozen in the space between cars. If Chris had decided to follow me, he could have crept onto the lot and hidden himself by the time I moved. I forced a deep breath into my lungs and tapped on the glass of the Mercedes. There was no response. I gripped the handle of the rear door, eased it open. Roadrunner sat propped up in the back seat, like a ventriloquist dummy. His eyes were half closed, and only the dullest reflection of the dome light came back from them. His fur hat had tumbled to his lap, and there was a red blossom of blood on the headrest behind him. He'd been shot through the forehead, the entry wound, like a vacant nail hole, where a picture used to hang. Diego was sprawled over the front seat. He'd gotten his from behind. Thick ropes of bloody saliva flowed from his mouth to cascade from the seat to his arm and down his sleeve to the floor. I still had my head in the Mercedes when I heard the other car. I pulled it out and whirled in time to see a stretch Hummer hurtling down the ramp. I clawed open the door to the Volkswagen and jumped into the driver's seat. I just managed to get the motor started, but it was wasted motion. The Hummer rammed me at a 45-degree angle, bulldozing me into the Mercedes and rattling me around the bug. Before I could collect my wits, two Asian guys in black pajamas came in through the passenger door and pulled me across the seat, out onto the muddy ground. One of them kicked me in the ribs for good measure. I heard the passenger door of the Hummer open. I looked up to see the car shiver on its suspension, and two stubby feet and legs thudded into the earth like concrete piers. I believe the last time we spoke, the topic was death, said a voice above me. The guys in the black pajamas yanked me to my feet, patted my torso down, and shoved a gun into my ribs. Wu stood across from me in the same t-shirt and bloomer pants. The squid tattoo below his ear sagged in the fleshy folds of his neck, but his smile was vigorous, jolly even. The fury from Gretchen's shooting rose within me. You picked this fight, Wu. You nearly killed someone very close to me.
And you killed my chef and threatened me and my family, neither of which will I forgive.
He turned back to the Hummer and pulled out a pair of enormous cleavers with black handles. There were no characters written on the side. I gathered these were not the sort to be used as calling cards. He looked at the cleavers almost wistfully, like they were an old baseball and glove from his youth.
I haven't used these for quite a while. The last time was to discipline one of my employees. He was a little shrimp of a guy, and he'd always been kind of a fuck-up, so we'd given him the affectionate nickname of Little Shit.
Does this story have a point?
It has a punchline. Before I started in with the cleavers, Little Shit shit his pants.
He grinned at me.
I told him he'd experienced an eponymous release because his name...
Yeah, I get it. He nodded at his men, who backed me up against the dirt wall of the excavation. They stepped away, keeping their guns trained on me and blocking my escape route to the ramp. If there ever was a time for the cavalry, it was now. My eyes darted around the property, searching for some sign of Chris. I saw nothing. Wu advanced, weaving the cleavers through the air in front of him.
If you are looking for your little fag friend, we've got him tied up in the back of the Humvee. I shouldn't think I'd let him play with guns in the future. Not that either of you have one.
My shoulders slumped, and my breathing went to nothing. My hands and face felt tingly and numb. I thought of walking into the blades to get it over with. Wu saved me by laughing. I vowed then I was going to hurt him somehow before it was over. What is this really about, Squid Boy? I asked. Why the rampage against me, the Lees, and everyone else?
Playing dumb may suit your personality, but it is not a winning strategy.
He touched the blades of the cleavers together, like a praying mantis rubbing its foreclaws.
Now, they tell me you keep a knife on your ankle. You may take it out if you think it could be of any value.
It was disheartening to know he'd already factored the knife into the equation, but I leaned down to pull it off my ankle, then realized it was nothing but a trick. Wu bulled forward with a surprising speed, slinging blades at my head and shoulders like a kind of grotesque Cuisinart. I dove onto the ground, rolled past him, and scrambled to my feet. He pivoted to face me, and I backpedaled quickly, drawing him out between me and his men. That left me so many steps further from the exit, but at least I wouldn't be backed up to the wall or sandwiched between them. Wu was already breathing hard, and his face glistened with a greasy sweat.
"Stand and fight, Reardon," he wheezed, "or we'll shoot you."
He was right. Both of his men had come up behind him and were busy drawing a bead on me with their pistols. I closed on Wu and feinted with a knife. One of the cleavers came whistling past my hand, shaving skin and more from my knuckles. I leapt back and pulled the hand to my midsection. He threw a cleaver at my chest. I managed to lift both arms, one hand gripping the other, and the cleaver caught me square in the left forearm, just below the elbow. It bit into bone, hung there for the briefest of instants, and then pulled out and plunked to the ground. I'd never felt so much pain. Wu came charging in for the kill. I backpedaled like crazy, but caught my foot on a piece of rebar and launched into a near-perfect backflop. It seemed like it took forever for me to hit the ground. While I sailed towards the black earth, I thought how puny my efforts had been. I worried about what would happen to Chris, but most of all, I wondered if I had hallucinated what I'd seen behind Wu and his men before I tripped. A backhoe blitzkrieging down the ramp. I crash-landed on my back and shoulders, but managed to avoid banging my head. I rolled to my right, fearing the bite of the other cleaver at any moment. It never came. What came instead were shouts, pistol fire, and the soft thud of bodies hitting metal. I rolled to a stop and pried myself off the ground. Wu was about 10 yards to the left, watching as his pajamaed henchmen were scooped up in the loader of a real steel and hydraulics backhoe. I'd lost my knife in the fall, but the cleaver he'd thrown at me lay partway between us. I sprinted towards it, flinging blood from the wound in my forearm as I came. I had my fingers around the handle by the time he turned. As I closed the distance between us, he brought the remaining cleaver up to swing at me, but I was on him before he could bring it forward. I chopped him in the neck, just below his tattoo, with everything I had. "Death!" I shouted into his fat face and cackled like a madman. Or maybe there was no like about it. Wu was too stunned to even react. Blood spurted from the wound, spraying me in the front of his massive chest. He stood stock still for a moment, his cleaver still raised above his head, and then the blade slipped from his hand and he toppled backward. He hit the ground with a sickening thud, his head wrenching over to reveal the deep V cut into his neck. He twitched and lay still. My face, chest, and arms were coated in blood, both Wu's and my own. I was laughing, mumbling to myself, and trying to wipe blood from my cheek with a jacket sleeve that was already saturated when Red, the ATM thief, came up beside me. He looked at me, then at Wu, and then back at me.
"Sweet Jesus," he said wonderingly, "and I thought you were taunting me about an ATM machine."
He didn't wait for a response or explanation, but turned and ran out of the pit.
"You owe me, man," he shouted over his shoulder.
He had trapped Wu's men in the loader against the wall of the excavation. I left them where they were and released Chris from the back of the Hummer. He was blubbering before I even got the gag out of his mouth and wrapped me in a hug in spite of the gore.
"Don't ever tell me to use my judgment again," he said into my ear.
I extricated myself from his embrace as the wail of the approaching siren came to us. But there was also a muffled pounding emanating from the back of Diego's car. I reached under the dash of the car to pop the trunk, and we found Cassia hogtied, but very much alive, in back. We had her propped up on the edge of the trunk by the time McQuaid and his partner Jerry skidded to a stop at the top of the ramp. There wasn't any friendly chit-chat about backhoes this time. They tumbled out of the cruiser to crouch behind its doors with guns drawn. McQuaid barked at us through the car's megaphone.
Everybody down on the ground with your hands behind your head.
You have been listening to Runoff, a book hard-boiled great James Crumley described as a smart, funny, spooky, often touching, always entertaining romp. Find it in ebook or trade paperback wherever books are sold. In this podcast, it's read by author Mark Coggins. Learn more about Mark and his other novels at markcoggins.com.